Okay, I think it's time to start this afternoon's session for something now for something completely different. We're going to finish the line, but we're going to talk about the other 90-something percent of neutron stars. We're going to be focusing a bit more on pulsars now, still with the magnetar bent to some extent. Our first speaker this afternoon is Alice Harding from Goddard, and she's going to talk about theory and observations of high B slow radio pulsars.
Okay, I'm not only going to talk about the high magnetic field radio pulsars, but also on their possible connection to magnetars. And I want to, first of all, point out my collaborators, Matthew Baring, who's our chair, so maybe I'll get a little extra time on this, and Bing Zhang. And I'm going to start out with a short observational summary of the high B radio pulsars. And then point out their comparison with the anomalous X-ray pulsars and SGRs. And it's the big question is, as you've seen, that high field pulsars are very close to some of the anomalous X-ray pulsars in the P.P diagram, yet they have very different observational characteristics. And how can that be understood? So I'm going to try to explore this question with respect to the fact that these may be very, well, at least the we know the high B radio pulsars are fairly high field, if also the AXPs and SGRs are also magnetars. It is possibly because of the high B that might there might be some differentiation between these two groups of objects. And I'm going to change the order here a little bit. I'll discuss some of the high B processes that are going on in the magnetosphere, not the ones that Jeremy Heil discussed, but ones that attenuate photons, one photon pair production and photon splitting, which operates in very high field. And then whether or not such a photon splitting process could, in fact, suppress the creation of pairs, which might make some of these things radio quiet. If a lot of the pulsar people believe that pairs are required, necessary but not sufficient condition for radio emission, then that might be a way to turn off the radio emission in the magnetars. And that's not the whole story, though, because some of these things are radio quiet and some of them are not. So one needs a different way to distinguish them. And I think at that point, one needs to look at the polar cap acceleration processes. And I'll argue that this suggests a unified model for these sources. So first of all, I've collected some of the, all of the high field pulsars I knew about as of a week ago, but I think there's a couple of extras. They keep growing now almost daily or weekly. So I've divided these into three groups, the high field radio pulsars, the anomalous X-ray pulsars and soft gamma ray repeaters, and then some other assortment of radio quiet pulsars. And I'm defining high field pulsar as pulsars with surface B field as defined by their period and period derivative, according to this expression, would be the pure dipole spin down. With breaking index of 3, surface field above the critical field of 3 times, 4 times 10 to the 13 Gauss. And I'll just point out that this coefficient here is a factor of 2 larger than the Taylor and Manchester coefficients. Well, it's a factor of 2 higher than what a lot of the radio observers have been using, and that's because we're assuming the magnetic dipole moment that is for a star center dipole, which you can derive Jackson in various places. So you actually do get a factor 2 higher field from that. So the high field radio pulsars now, they're all from the Parkes multibeam survey, and there's 4 of them now above the critical field, and there probably will be more as they get more and more P dots. There's a variety of periods here. They're all high P dot and fairly short lifetime, fairly short lifetime. The anomalous X-ray pulsars with measured P dots are about 5, and they have this narrow period range, as has been discussed now, from 6 to 12 seconds, and also high P dots and fairly young objects, and the two SGRs with measured P dots also fall in this very narrow period range. And then there's some radio quiet pulsars which have just recently been discovered. KES 75 pulsar that Eric Gotthelf talked about yesterday, 0.3 second period, and very interestingly high magnetic field, a very young object. And then this pulsar in a supernova remnant, 1207, with 0.4 second period. And if you use the supernova age, you can estimate what the P dot would have to be. And therefore, you get an interestingly high field here, too. And then I'm just including this other radio quiet pulsar, but it's not a high field pulsar. It's in 157B in the LMC. And then there's another one, I think, in the back of the room that I actually didn't add to this list. So these last things, some of them may be magnetars, some of them may be AXPs. We don't know yet. So where do these things fall now on the PP dot diagram? You've seen this diagram a number of times already, but I've put lines of constant field strength now on the diagram, according to how I define it. And so the radio pulsar surveys, the Princeton catalogs in black, Parks multibeam is in blue, and the high field pulsars in my table are with little triangles around them. And the AXPs and the SGRs are in red and green. And then these other assorted radio quiet pulsars are in orange. So now the thing to notice is there's a AXP here, 2259, I think, very close to this high field radio pulsar, 1814. Yet this one is barely radio quiet. It's got a very low radio upper limit. And the high field radio pulsar is fairly X-ray quiet. This is the upper limit Pavlovarov has obtained from archival data. They have pretty low ASCA upper limits, which are a factor about an order of magnitude lower than you would expect for, this is the AXP count rate. So these things are not behaving the same way, yet they're very close in their period derivative. Now this one is the KES 75 pulsar. It's possibly a very young AXP making its way across the diagram, might eventually end up over here. And it's very close to another high field pulsar. So here's a radio quiet thing next to a radio loud thing, and a radio loud thing over here next to radio quiet thing. So it's really, they're kind of all mixed together in phase space. And the question is, how do you really differentiate their behavior? Well, one thing you could do is to draw the line separating where pulsars are rotationally dominated from where they're magnetically dominated. And if you just equate b squared over 8 pi times the volume of a neutron star with the total rotational energy, that's what this line is. And this Parks survey pulsar actually falls right in that line, which is interesting. Presumably still looks like a rotationally powered pulsar. Of course, this line could be fuzzy. That's just a really rough estimate. But most of the radio pulsars we love are in rotational space. And all of the AXPs are in magnetic space. So that you say, well, maybe that's dividing these things. But then what if this is an AXP? It's behaving like it could be at some point behaving like it's magnetically dominated when it's not. So there's another line you can draw here, which Matthew Baring and I suggested a couple of years ago, which is the line above which photon splitting dominates over pair production at the surface of the star for photons emitted right along the field line. So that means that everything above, very simplistically, everything above this line could be radio quiet if photon splitting is completely suppressing pair creation, and everything below this line could be radio loud. Well, when we drew this line, we hadn't seen these pulsars yet, and then they cropped up and they were above this line. So you might ask, well, that's really not a radio quiescence line. So why are these high field radio pulsars above that line? So, and I'll discuss this a little bit. We decided to look at this so-called photon splitting death line in a little more detail. And before I do that, I'll just go through some of the basics. The magnetic pair production is first order process. In fact, it's surprising at first that photon splitting would ever dominate over magnetic pair production, because photon splitting is a third order process. Every time you add a vertex, you add another factor of alpha to the cross section. So right off, photon splitting is a factor of alpha squared smaller than pair production. But the catch is that magnetic pair production has a threshold. The photon has to have at least 2mc squared to produce the pair, and if you conserve parallel energy, that threshold becomes 2mc squared over sine of between the angle of the photon propagation and the field. So what happens is that these high energy photons have to be emitted by relativistic particles that are streaming along the field. The relativistic particles emit the photons into very small angles, 1 over gamma. They're all below pair threshold when they start out. So they have to propagate in the curved magnetic field until they attain this angle, such that they can be above pair threshold at some point. So because of that propagation time to the pair production point, there is time for photon splitting to actually attenuate the photon. And notice that the photon splitting rate goes as V6. So if you start to increase the field near and above V critical, this rate actually gets large enough that you can split the photon before it pair produces. And that's how this works.
That formula doesn't apply above.
No, that's right. I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't say that. This is only applying up to around several times V critical, and then it saturates.
And isn't there an angle?
Yes, there's an angle. I left a lot of stuff out. That's why this is the proportional, not exact. But this is just a simple way to show that it does change fast below V critical until you get up to that point. Okay, so to see where this point is, that pair production, photon splitting takes over from pair production, the best thing to do is compare the escape energies of the photons. And that escape energy is the energy above which the photon will escape from the surface through the whole magnetosphere. And this is the escape energies for pair production, the function of magnetic colatitude of a photon. And when they're emitted at 0 degrees to the field, which is the dotted line, or at some angle to the field, which changes things at very small colatitudes. And this is as a function of magnetic field, in terms of the critical field. You can see that the pair production escape energies saturate at high field. This is because of the threshold effect. Photon splitting, on the other hand, the escape energies vary faster with increasing field, and in fact don't saturate nearly as much as those of pair production. As Jeremy just pointed out, it does eventually saturate as several be critical. But at some point, these curves cross over, and they cross over at a little below B critical. That's still when the photon splitting rate is increasing fairly quickly. So if you see where that crossover point is, then that's why. That's the source of these splitting death lines in the PP dot diagram. And here's the one I drew before, where the zero angle of the photon emission to the field at the surface. And that's this line. And if you increase the angle of the photon emission, you start to drop this line a little below, a lot below, if it's 10 to the minus 2 radians. However, the gammas of these relativistic particles that are doing the radiating are something like 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 7. So it's essentially thought to be zero angle to the field for these high energy photons. So, and the other interesting thing is if you emit the photons a little higher above the surface, you can avoid splitting for a while longer, and you don't have this splitting death line until a little bit higher up at higher B fields. So that would allow these things to be radio pulsars if the photons could be emitted at some distance above the surface. Well, that's half, Yep, that's half the stellar radius above the surface. Yeah, so it does actually go up pretty fast with increasing altitude. Thanks, Matthew. Okay, now the other effect is that can reduce pairs is if the photon, the pair production, cross-section, actually is such that you produce pairs in very high states at low B fields. This is the number of kinematically available Landau states. The pair is a function of photon energy. So you're producing a pair with thousands of available Landau states at B of 0.05 B critical. But as you go up to tenths of B critical, then you basically are producing the pair in lower and lower Landau states. And that means that there's less and less synchrotron emission in the cascades. And there's, that means there's less and less potential pair production. And I'll show how that works. And this is kind of a what cascades might look like as a function of field strength at low fields, like below 0.1 B critical. These are the pulsars we know for as radio pulsars, most of them. Both polarization modes of the photon can pair produce, and each of those pairs will radiate many synchrotron photons because they're in high Landau states. Each one of those will radiate, will pair produce, and those pairs will produce more multiple synchrotron photons, and so you get a lot of amplification of the number of pairs and very prolific pair cascades, and lots of radio emission, therefore, I guess. But if you increase the field above about 0.1, you start to get this ground state pair creation, reducing the number of pairs, because parallel mode photons will produce pairs both in the ground state, but perpendicular mode photons can produce maybe one pair in an excited state. That can radiate one synchrotron photon. In the perpendicular state, it can radiate one more synchrotron photon, and you can keep this going a little bit, but you can tell that there are going to be a lot fewer pairs than in this case. Now, about B of 0.5 B critical, photon splitting will come in. And as Chris Thompson and Rob Duncan are assuming in most of their models, there is a kinematic selection rule that's valid. We know it's valid at low dispersion, which means low fields, reasonably low fields, and which allows only one mode of splitting. This is the perpendicular photons can only split into two parallel mode photons. Now this means that you can only have one generation of splitting in any cascade, because the parallel photons then can't split, they have to pair produce. And that means that the parallel mode photons can produce pairs in the ground state, but perpendicular mode photons can split only once, and then those split photons produce pairs. And that's the end of it. So there's very few pairs, but there's still some. So you do not shut off pair creation completely with one mode of splitting. Now, the case Matthew and I have been looking at is that if you do have high dispersion, which you do eventually get in very high fields above B critical, this is a dispersive situation because at least you have vacuum dispersion, if nothing else. There are other available, there are other possible modes allowed by QED which can split both polarization modes of the photon, and they can split into the two opposite polarization modes, and in that case you can have purely splitting cascades with no pairs if splitting is dominating the cross section. So you can just split photons to lower and lower energies. Now, you can turn off pair production completely that way as long as you can split photons fast enough that they don't get into the lower fields before pair production starts coming in again. So that's the big question. I'm going to better speed this up. Okay, so we've done some simulations of these hair cascades, and I'm going to have to go through this pretty fast, but basically, if you have no splitting, and this is injecting photons with the power law, a zero angle to the field, 5 degrees co-latitude, and this is the pair yield per photon. You can see that this is for different maximum energies of the photon. If you have large enough energies of the photons, you get lots of pairs at relatively low field, and then you start to decrease the number of pairs as one photon, or as ground state pair production comes in, and then you basically don't decrease the pairs too much more as long as you have only one splitting mode operating. But if you do have all three splitting modes operating, then you do effectively turn off the pairs at about, starting at about half to one be critical. And this shows it a little more. The contour plot, function of B over B critical versus the period, you can see that most of the pair yield comes in for relatively short periods and lower magnetic fields, and it starts to decrease in higher fields and then kind of shuts off completely with three modes of splitting operating above about B critical. And this is actually this going this direction is the pulsar death line, where you shut off pairs just due to the geometry of the polar cap. Okay, so, but that, of course, even if you have three modes of splitting operating and you can shut off pair creation, it still doesn't account for why some of the pulsars are radio loud in that section of the diagram. And this might be understood by looking at the possible acceleration gaps that can be operating above, at least in a pulsar magnetosphere above the polar cap. If the surface temperature of the neutron star is larger than the thermionic emission temperature, then you're going to be able to pull any sign of charge out that you need. Now, if the pulsar is spinning with the rotation axis parallel to the magnetic axis, that's greater than zero, then the space charge above the polar cap is negative. The space charge or co-rotation charge goes as minus omega dot b. So, therefore, you can pull out electrons with no problem and accelerate them above the surface. If you've got omega dot b less than zero, you'd like to have ions pulled out, and you can do that if this TS is greater than the ion emission temperature. Now, these emission temperatures, they're at least the ion temperature is a little bit uncertain. There are lots of different calculations that give you slightly different results, but they do go as different powers in the B field. And I've scaled these to 10 to the 14 Gauss. Now, this is fairly dangerous because all of these calculations only go up to 10 to the 13 Gauss. But I'm going to do it anyway, so we'll see what the consequences are. If you look at regular pulsar field strengths of 10 to the 12, these two thermionic emission temperatures are roughly the same. They're about 5 times 10 to the 5 Kelvin, and most of the pulsars have measured temperature, surface temperatures at least above that or around that. So we believe that this situation, space charge gap, applies to most radio pulsars. However, if you increase the field to 10 to the 14 or so, you extrapolate these thermionic emission temperature laws, then you can get into the situation where your surface temperature has gone, your emission temperature is high enough that your surface temperature could be below that, in which case you have vacuum gaps. You hold the particles you would like to have into the magnetosphere into the surface. And you create a vacuum, which can only be broken down by a random photon coming in, creating a pair, and the pair separating by just accelerating in opposite directions, and that creates the current. So, the difference now is that if you have space charge gap, you can accelerate these particles to fairly high altitude before they pair produce. So, if you start out at the surface, and suppose you have photon splitting dominating in all three modes, you completely prevent pair creation until this particle just keeps accelerating, though, because you don't have any pairs to shut off the parallel, until you get out into the further out into the magnetosphere, where you have B dropping, and therefore you have pair creation, and you can have some pairs and possibly radio emission at higher altitudes. But if you have a vacuum gap, you actually don't. You have to break down that gap at the surface, which means that you are going to have a dead pulsar if you don't have any pair creation. So The possibility here then is that you have the photon splitting death line around where I drew it before. This is for surface emission. But now, if you're a parallel rotator, you have the possibility of having a space charge gap all the way up to this line, which is the electron space charge death line for parallel rotators. And therefore, in this little region here, you can have radio loud things that are emitting their photons that are pair producing way above the surface. However, some of these, like the AXPs, may in fact be anti-parallel rotators, where they would like to have, well, they have to have vacuum gaps, but those vacuum gaps cannot produce pairs. So this is a possibility, a suggestion, of how to resolve this problem of how some things are radio quiet and some things are radio loud. Now, above this death line, nothing can be radio loud if all three modes of splitting are operating. So if you see radio pulsars up here, that will kill the three-mode splitting idea pretty much. So, and of course, this line can move up and down a little bit. So I had a nice view graph, but you'll have to look at it on the web. So maybe I'll just put it up here, and then we can talk about it later.
Thanks, Alice. Questions? Maxine?
Two questions. First, you mentioned that you can split both modes.
I think it's possibly. We don't know the physics of this yet. We have to explore that physics, that very highly dispersive field strength.
The second question is, you're modeling it probably with a dipole field, which has large radii of curvature. And then the number of pairs that you produce also depends on radial
curvature.
I wonder how much this results from changing your two multipoles and the radial curvature of the order of the Newton star radius. Many more pairs or same order?
Well, no, actually everything changes when you decrease the radius of curvature. I mean, it's very dependent on that. And what we've done so far is just to assume the pure dipole geometry, because actually most of the radio pulsar morphology indicates dipoles, although that might be probing the surface. So it's a little bit dangerous, but you know, if you include very high multipoles, you're going to get a lot more pairs.
Chris?
Dispersion remains weak until we get to 10 to 16 gauss.
You mean the vacuum dispersion?
The one loop correction.
The higher order correction of order alpha smaller than the one loop correction of arbitrarily large, not arbitrarily large fields, but well beyond this regime.
It depends.
By Dittrich.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, including the pair creation contributions on shell from splitting.
I'm unclear about that. The problem is
it goes on shell, it becomes like pair creation.
Yeah, strength. That's the one thing that could make a difference.
Higher order processes should do this.
That's if your photon is at a particular frequency, the cyclotron. Or...
Yeah. Okay, Don?
Louder?
Yeah, that's the main problem. Not only is it uncertain below 10 to the 13 gauss, we're extrapolating it above that. Yeah. Yes. Oh, okay. Okay. I didn't talk about outer gap models at all. Roger presumably is going to talk about that.
So.
For one thing, the outer gap model doesn't really claim to be producing all the radio emission. Most of the radio emission is supposed to come, we think, from less than tens of stellar radii. So it is a near surface phenomenon and probably requires the pairs that you produce near the surface. But of course that's all, you know, current thinking. We don't know. It might be.
Mel?
How
have two questions that you can answer when you want to.
Do I get to pick?
The first is, if I look at the separation between location and power, that's also the location between the very slowly rotating. Mm-hmm. If I have a very slowly rotating pulsar, and you expect to be that way,
mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's
I made this calculation. You need to find an order of maybe a dozen to 20 AXPs to be certain that you had at least a 50% chance of actually seeing having the radio being aimed at you if the beam is so small. And I mean, it's bound to happen in the next few years to get to that point.
These are X-ray rather more, so we have a lot of X-rays coming from the surface of the neuron, especially from the peripheral. We have a lot of X-rays. We can also make pairs and gamma rays in there.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, you have to worry about that. The more you use those photons before those photons fitting and reflecting is down to such a low energy that they are nervous.
Mm-hmm. I think Bing Zhang has looked at this, the photon-photon pair creation near the surface, and he's found that to make that important, the surface temperature to supply enough X-ray photons has to be pretty high. Something higher than what they are seeing right now. But, there is a paper on that that he's... No, he's talking about the polar cap. Yeah, is this the polar cap? Right. But to have the accelerator start, okay, I guess you have to pair production to start the accelerator, so it's kind of a non-linear whatever. But, I don't know if you can heat it up that high, though. It's pretty high temperature. At least 5 or 6 times 10 to the... Let's see, what was it? Yeah, at least 5 times 10 to the 6, I think.
Is that high because of the very small magnetic field or something?
No, actually, let's see. He hasn't looked at the magnetic field effect on the photon-photon cross-section, if that's what you're asking.
Just for once, I'll assert fairly firmly that pair creation over the standard pulsar is validated by common scattering.
Yeah.
And I imagine polar cap,
That's one photon. Yeah, right.
I'm ignoring all this stuff with cascades, but I don't know where this 5, 10, and 6 number comes from.
Oh, that's just getting, simply getting enough density of photons.
That's one.
Okay.
I think we need to move along. Sri, do you have one last question?
I just want to remind you that, you know, even though you carefully used P and P dot throughout, but to the end you had a P and P diagram, that these P's are probably not very meaningful. We already know for 2259 that the P dot is not what makes astronomical sense by at least a factor of 10. And these things vary tremendously. They seem to go into on states, off states. It might well be that these AXPs and SGRs are really not that seemingly close in your diagram.
That's that line here. Yeah. Now, I didn't do this for the AXPs, but
I'm saying that 2259, we do know that P dot is off. So maybe it's not time to panic yet.
No, except that, I mean, if they're somewhere in the magnetar range there, you're still going to have to worry. I mean, there's a big uncertainty due to winds but...
Okay. Thanks, Alice. We need to move along, and we're going to get the outer gap picture now from Roger Romani. He's going to talk about non-thermal emission from young radio pulsars.